Last call. Reminds me of the guy whose the clapper fell out of his church bell, so he was running at it and hit it with his head a couple times, and then he missed, and he fell, and he landed on the sidewalk below. Somebody walked by. Who is that guy? I said, I don't know, but his face rings a bell. The music of the spheres, a harmonious universe like a harp. Its rhythms are the equal repeated seasons, the beating of the heart. Day, night, the going and returning of migratory birds, the cycles of stars and corn. The mimosa that unfolds by day and folds up again by night. Rhythms of mood, moon and tide, one single rhythm in planets, atoms, sea. An apple that ripens and falls in the mind of Newton. Melody, accords, arpeggios, the harp of the universe, unity behind apparent multiplicity. That is the music. Welcome this morning to Unitarian Fellowship of Manhattan. We have a lot to fit in today, so we're going to keep it moving. Fast, slow, tall, short, all are welcome here. Welcome to the Unitarian Fellowship. I want to call your attention to the announcements printed in the order of service. And are there any other announcements? Harriet. Okay, so women's lunch will be at the Little Apple Brewery. Correction to the... Not Carlos O'Kelly's. All right. Any further announcements? Okay, chalice light. You're up. Where is it? We hallow this time together by kindling the lamp of our heritage. Told you it would be short. Our opening hymn, I chose this in honor of Kansas and the beautiful, beautiful summer that we've jumped into directly out of a beautiful winter. Home on the Range is, I believe, a somewhat neglected song, often relegated to the realm of children's nursery rhymes, but is actually the state song of Kansas, written by a Dr. Brewster M. Higley. Originally wrote the words in a poem called My Western Home in the early 1870s in Smith County, Kansas. The poem was first published in December 1873 issue of the Smith County Pioneer under the title Oh Give Me a Home Where the Buffalo Roam. The music was written by a friend of Higley's named Daniel E. Kelly. Higley's original words are similar to those of the song today, but not identical. The original words are included in the insert to your service. The song was adopted by settlers, cowboys, and others who spread across the USA in various forms. During the early 20th century, it was arranged by a Texas composer, David Guion, who is often credited as the composer. Officially adopted by the State Song of Kansas on June 30th, 1947, and is commonly regarded as the unofficial anthem of the American West. So with all the dignity and solemnity we can muster, we will now sing Home on the Range.
Do the chorus as it's listed here rather than the way normal people normally sing it?
We're going to say these words.
Yeah. Well, oh, Home on the Range. Well, I don't know where that came
from.
Home on the Range. Right. And accompanied by Michael Oldfather and our guest artist this morning, Jennifer Bryan, on the violin. Please stand as you're able.
Oh. draws its light from the glittering stream, where glideth along the graceful white swan, like the maid in her heavenly dream.
Could do it. Joys and concerns, if there are anything that anyone would like to share with us, good or bad. Nothing happened. Sylvia Beeman has volunteered to lead us in the children's story for all ages. And if all the little ones would like to come up and have a seat.
Well, hello. How are you on this gorgeous day? Today, Jennifer Bryan is going to be talking to the big people about her great love of music and how she plays string instruments and what that's meant to her in her life. And she loves string instruments so much, she plays viola and violin, that she calls herself Violinifer. Isn't that funny? Very clever, too. And I, yes? That's a very good caution, yes. So everyone remember that. Be careful of flame. Could be dangerous, but yes. Oh, do you like her? Mm-hmm. I think I know her, Linda Cohagan. She's a very good teacher.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I'm going to tell you a story about Vernon, a fellow named Vernon Quigley. And like Jennifer, he loved music, and so did his whole family. In fact, as soon as his family woke up, every morning they sang a special song, and it went like this. And then when they, just before they went to bed at night, they sang another special song, and they all sang it together, and it went like this. Oh, I forgot to tell you that the Quigleys were birds. Well, Vernon loved music just as much as his whole family, but anytime he opened his mouth to sing, all that came out was, honk. And his mother said, I don't recall there being any geese in my side of the family. And her husband said, Well, I like having a son who's an individual. But Vernon got teased a lot. Sometimes his brothers and sisters laughed at him, and he was really embarrassed that he was so different from everyone in the family. So anytime they would be singing, he held all his music of his mind and his heart deep in his chest, and he never sang anymore. And things got a little more complicated when he went to school, because everyone had to be in a music group, and so Vernon decided he was not going to be in the chorus like everyone in his family did. They were all wonderful singers from generations back, and everyone in town knew they were wonderful singers, but he was so embarrassed and ashamed about his voice, he decided to join the orchestra. So the first day of orchestra, the orchestra conductor, her name was Mrs. Belfry. She gave him a violin, and she was a bat. Anyway, playing the violin posed some challenges for Vernon, a bird, because you can imagine he had no fingers. So it was really hard for him to hold the violin, and there were no other birds in the orchestra. Everyone else in the orchestra, there were monkeys and some possums and mice and squirrels and raccoons, and they all had little fingers. But Vernon, he got one of his friends in the orchestra to attach the violin each day with some rubber bands, and then they attached the bow on his other hand. So he just pretended like he was playing, because he could only play four notes. He couldn't move his fingers like you'll see Jennifer do on her viola. And so he always sat in the very back row so no one could see him, and because the orchestra conductor was a bat, she had very good hearing, but she never really seemed to notice that he was doing that. So his parents often asked him, well, how's orchestra going? And they were kind of pleased to have an orchestra member in their family. That had never happened. And he always just said, oh, it's fine. We'll be having a concert in a couple months. And we never hear you practice. Oh, I practice at school, he said. So the day the big concert came, and all the families of all the kids in the orchestra came, and I'll get you a question at the end, okay? So all the families came, and they looked so proud of their kids and the orchestra, and the Quigleys were all lined up there. But Vernon was sitting in the very back row, and he was kind of little compared to some of the bigger animals, and nobody could really see him. So the first couple pieces they played were very slow and a little monotonous, and a couple people started to fall asleep in the orchestra, in the audience. But then they started to play his favorite piece, which was the Blue Danube Waltz. And for the back row of the orchestra, Vernon pretended he was playing his violin. But then something happened. He loved this music so much that some sounds burst out of his chest. Honk, honk. Honk, 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 honk. Honk, 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 honk. Honk, honk. Oh, he was afraid to look at what his parents' faces were showing, but the audience broke out in riotous laughter and cheers as soon as they finished. There was nobody sleeping then. They were so excited. It was so wonderful and unusual and such a different interpretation than they had ever heard. They thought it was one of those kind of pieces just thrown in the middle of the orchestra to kind of get everyone's attention and wake them up. Well, somehow he made it through the rest of the concert without making another peep and just pretending he was playing his violin. And he was putting his violin away with the rest of the students after the concert, trying to figure out how he was going to face his parents. And Mrs. Belfry said, excuse me, young man, I would like to have a few words with you.
Yes, ma'am.
She really looked at him with her beady black eyes for the very first time. I believe you're a songbird, aren't you?
Yes, ma'am.
And a very unusual one at that. And I liked your improvisation, by the way. That was quite a hit with the audience.
Thank you, Mrs. Belfry.
However, I'm noticing that you must have been struggling all this time in the orchestra.
Yes, ma'am.
And I'm thinking we can maybe make some accommodations. How about if we transfer you to the band, the horn section? Yes, ma'am. That's a great idea. Well, then he had to face his parents. But his family said, instead of being embarrassed or ashamed of him like he expected, they said, oh, the orchestra, the whole concert was wonderful. And we were especially proud of how you started to sing again. We thought you'd completely lost your voice and we missed it so much.
Oh, it was nothing.
I know that must have been very hard for you playing the violin all these days. Now I realize, said his parents.
Well, I think there are going to be some changes.
So the next day at school, he turned in his violin, and he didn't need to have an instrument because he could honk all by himself. And he joined the horn section in the band, and it was really a good fit. And he had quite a lot of fun because the elephants were there and the trumpeter swans, and those guys are quite a bit of fun, you can imagine. So, and that's the story about how Vernon learned to express his own unique voice and not have it all locked up, his song of his heart and his mind locked up in his chest, not expressed. And so I hope all of you find in your life ways to sing your songs. The end. Oh, did you have a question? Did you want to make a comment? Oh, maybe you can get it when you walk out and you can let it out the door. Okay, that's all. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you, Sylvia. As is our tradition, once a month we donate our collection as Helping Hand Sunday to a worthwhile public service or organization in the community. This month it is to the Boys and Girls Club of Manhattan. So anything, well, we will have Ms. Leah Ost, a representative of the Boys and Girls Club, give a little presentation on their mission and where they're going and what they do. Thank you. Leah?
It's nice to be here today. Thank you for having me. And my name is Leah Ost. I work for the Boys and Girls Club of Manhattan, and I've been there for about 2 years. I started out as their admin assistant, and I'm now their marketing and PR coordinator. So it's nice to see you today. And thank you also for your past support that you guys have given us as well. I just wanted to talk to you a little bit today about, I went to a conference last week, and our new big thing is about impact. And so I want to talk about the three different areas of impact that we strive to work on. And the first one is we are here to serve all the people in our community, whether in Manhattan or the surrounding areas, ages 5 all the way through teens in high school, whether they have little money or lots of money. It doesn't matter. We are not here just for the poor or wealthy or anything like that. Everybody's welcome at the Boys and Girls Club. We serve ages 5, oh, I said through teens. The teen club is separate from the actual Fifth Street site, which is like kindergarten through sixth grade. So that's something that's a little bit separate that you may not know of. It's smaller, but we serve about 2,000 kids a year, and 1,000 of those, 1,000 members came at least 52 times last year. So for us, if you come 52 times a year, that's a point where you can actually start to impact a child. And so our goal is always to have them in regular attendance every year, 52 times. The next goal is 104, if we can double that attendance. Also, I think I had one more statistic for you. Oh, 500 kids per day. And also, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the Boys and Girls Club, but some of you might know of our main 5th Street site, which is down off of Pierre and 5th. And that is our main site. But we also have 7 other school-based sites in town. So some of the kids come from Northview, for instance, and they come over on a bus. We have about 4 different buses that come to the 5th Street, but then we also have the individual sites that kids are at as well. And so, for instance, Marlatt and Lee Elementary, they all have their own spot. And so anyways, the next thing is we try to have 5 key elements within our program. The first one is a safe and positive environment. The second one is supportive relationships. So when we hire staff there, we hire almost 50 staff. Memberships there for the kids are $30 per year. So 78% of our money goes towards making sure that we can have the right people in the right place to be supportive of these kids. Our third thing is to offer a fun environment. We want to be able to have programs that these kids can engage in and learn and grow and be better people and not just learn, not be a school after school, but be an enrichment program for these kids after school. We also want to offer opportunity and high expectations for these kids to be able to get what they don't get at home, possibly because their parents may have to work late or have night shift jobs and they need somebody there to guide them. The last thing is recognition and achievement. We may do little things when they do something well. They put their name in a jar, a happy face jar, and they pick something out. And then at the end of the week, we have an assembly, and that's where they can get recognized for good behavior and learning new things. And we also do pre- and post-tests throughout the year, so we can actually track if a child is excelling through their schoolwork or if they need help throughout the semester of school. Other thing is we also incorporate high-yield activities, targeted programs, and we promote the regular attendance, like I said before. Some of our programs include Club Tech, Net Smarts, Triple Play, and Project Learn. All of these, whether they're promoting a healthy lifestyle in the gym or we're teaching them about the right things to be eating or what not to be eating, we have a program with the state that actually, I have to run and figure out what kind of snack they can have after school, whether it offers the right food groups, as well as breakfast in the morning. So it gets a little bit challenging trying to order food that's actually good for you sometimes when you're ordering in bulk. But it's good for them, and so it keeps me going. So let's see. Last thing. Part of the conference that we had talked about was measuring our success. And at the Boys and Girls Club, we do a lot to be able to measure everything that we do. We track them in, and when they come in to each individual program that I was talking about, we scan them in with a card so we can see their attendance throughout the day. So every day that they come, we have it in the computer system. We're able to run reports. We're able to see whether they're improving in school and so forth. So the other thing is academic success. So our last thing is to be able to see that they can actually get to the end and graduate from high school and go on, and we follow them throughout. We have one kid right now that comes back, and he's actually in a band, and he's all excited because he has a CD, and he comes and he shows us. So it's really neat to see the improvements and the self-esteem that they have. Good character and citizenship. We try to make sure that, they're able to be involved and volunteer within the community is important. They need to give back what they receive and so forth. And then lastly is the healthy lifestyles. We're able to track and see, are these kids participating in the after-school snack, make sure that all of them have a snack after school, and so forth. So I hope you learned a little bit about today. I know right now I'm doing a one campaign. We do 2 fundraisers a year. We don't do any more than that. In the one campaign, I had all of our staff. We have to have 100% participation donation from just our staff alone. And so I've been going around to them. But on their cards, I make them write on the back something that impacted them from a kid. And one of the ones that kind of touched me was the fact that she said, you know, I always give hugs to my kids, but one of them came up to me and she said that, you know, I really appreciate the Boys and Girls Club because every day I can look forward to getting a hug from you and I don't get to have that at home. So that's just a thought that I wanted to leave with you. So thank you for having me and I hope you learned something.
Thank you, Leah. It's a wonderful service you're doing there. So any donation that is not specifically noted on the check for the fellowship or put in the envelope will be today donated to the Boys and Girls Club. We have a personal reflection by Bryce Hobrock and then a musical etude played by Slavomir. Bryce?
I'm the latest in a series of testimonials about what UUFM means to me. This is with the mind that our annual meeting is coming up next Sunday, and I hope that you will be as inspired as I am about who we are and what we do here. My perspective may be a little bit different than the younger members that have spoken here in the past on this same theme, but not necessarily. I think our goals are all very, very much the same. And even though I may be older on the calendar, I very much care about the same things that the younger persons do. When I was writing my notes, I was reminded of the spontaneous testimonials that used to occur in the churching of my youth, in which the members filled with the Holy Spirit would rise to their feet and tell what their religious life meant to them. I think we're a bit more scripted here in how we feel about things, and that will be the nature of what I speak of. I've been a member of this fellowship for only about the last 12 years or so, and this is the only organized religious group I belong to since I was a small-town Methodist in western Kansas. I left that community 56 years ago. My youthful views came from my parents, who were very religious in a fundamentalist sense, having descended from Puritans and Calvinists, believing the concept of original sin from which one must be released, the inerrancy of the Old and New Testament, the literal creation story, the young earth, and how it will all end. I spent my young years listening for the trumpets announcing the rapture, believing that I would be the only person left behind. Over the intervening years, when my parents asked me how I was doing with my spiritual life, I had to evade the question, just saying, I'm okay, and actually I was okay. I did not necessarily attend a church that they understood, or any church, certainly not one that believes that one is born without original sin. Although I dabbled with Unitarian groups in Utah, New Jersey, and Nebraska, I always felt I did not need a formal affiliation with any spiritual group. However, as a member of I find that the rewards are many. So what does UUFM mean to me? Well, it means, number one, being a member of a community where I feel comfortable, one that does not threaten me, accepts me for what I am, and gives me access to others who are interested in seeking truth and justice. It gives me access to friendships, to people who concern themselves with things that matter, who care about others and not just themselves. In this fellowship, I meet people I admire. Some of the smartest and finest human beings I've ever known are found here. It means working to sustain this place, a tangible way to leave a legacy to the children, a safe place for them to learn about caring for others and acquiring a moral sense. As an older person, I feel responsibility to the future generations. And more pragmatically, this is a way of spending Sunday in a way that makes the day meaningful rather than a day to fret about tomorrow. You know how Monday mornings are. But there are responsibilities for being a member here. And often we put the term stewardship to that. And what does that mean? Because if you go to Wikipedia like I did, you'll find that it has many, many different meanings. But the way that it applies here, it means taking care of something valuable that is worthwhile and needs nurturing and sustaining. Therefore, our context here is for stewardship, is taking care of our fellowship. That means participation, seeing that our programs are sustained through our personal involvement with leadership, in programming, and just in discussions about meaning and what it is it all about. It also means pledging financial support for programs that we collectively agree that are important. You will recall the survey just finished that said that we all care about, number one, community, quality Sunday programming, and religious education for our children. And as I recall, no individual person failed to identify religious education as a priority. So, next meeting, next Sunday, is our annual meeting. There's a flyer about it in the program. I hope that you will make it a priority to attend. And finally, I hope that we will all be good stewards and take good care of UUFM.
Our featured speaker today grew up in Dallas, Texas, spent a large part of her early life studying music, specifically the violin, studying at the Suzuki Institute. She relocated to Manhattan in 2009. Jennifer Bryan has fast become a much sought-after performer at concerts and civic events locally. I know she has at least two CDs and has played in the Symphony Orchestra, Dallas, Fort Worth. Plays and teaches violin, works a regular job, and still has time to be an altogether great person, my friend Jennifer. With the Sermon on the Meadow Mount.
A most wonderful thing happened just during Slavomir's piece. The children that were listening to Sylvia's beautiful story came with their religious education teachers and started running out under our enormous, beautiful tree out here. And their teacher lifted them up to look at the bird feeders, and it was very nice. The Academy Tai Chi Lawrence taught me to listen beyond the windows and then out to the street and then out to the community. And because the windows were open, we got to hear the children making their lovely song. I brought a little bit of red wine up to the podium with me. Leonard Bernstein, apparently, when he was... at rehearsal would often have scotch brought to him out at the podium. And he did much work in disarmament, which was something that I'll talk about a little more. And then the third thing before we start is, as an adult, I have discovered MHTP, Music for Healing and Transition Program, which mainly focuses on teaching how to play for people who are critically ill, chronically ill, or even actively dying. And I'm going to play just a little bit during my talk. But and I think the first piece I play might kind of be an example of what someone might play for someone actively dying. It's a way to play without any specific things for someone to grab onto, because there's a time to try to keep going and a time to not. I also invite you to look over at the tree outside anytime during the talk that you feel, because I do that a lot. And I'm still listening, but I won't feel badly if your heads are turned that way. This poem and the next one I wrote June 9th, 2007. And it's, I guess in a way, it's kind of my disarmament poem, again, in honor of Lenny. And actually, because it was written in 2007, some of the arms that I speak of in this were, have actually, in the last 10 years, over half of them destroyed, and the persistent landmines, and are discontinued use for the United States. So this was written 4 years ago. Sucre. We don't know what happens when we die in our sleep. Perhaps it's a worse fate than death. Perhaps it feels like quicksand. Maybe it's the moan of a landfill burping yet another paper towel. The polar bear who paddles slowly to a non-existent glacier is just glad that he doesn't have to die in his sleep. He knows it is an overrated experience. Dying while sleeping might feel like being assigned as the personal assistant to a president that you really disliked, that one that you like to flick the tube off on in much haste. Remember, this was 4 years ago. That fate of which we speak laughs at us as we wish for it. In our thoughts, it knows what comes. Those who we kill with our bombs and scar and maim with our thousands of landmines feel for an instant what we will feel for an eternity. While we die in our sleep, we lose our beloved cats and dogs. Our children fall from towers. Our tongues hang cold with our ice and sugar drinks. Your face. There was a real quick smell that I scented. It was from the annals of eighth or ninth grade, and it was glued forever to Roberta Flack singing "The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face" when I listened to that forever on a little 45. Over and over I would listen as I wished and cried for something that did not come and never will, and that scent came for half a split second just a few ago, and I know from whence it came, but it left quite quick. Considering that this is the era of archives, I would like to begin by wishing a happy fourth birthday to Henry Ambrose. His father wrote "Shadow on the Moon," a song I have had the fortune to record. I went to visit them this year in Austin at my spring break from work when Henry was exactly the age and month that I was when I started playing the violin. His sister Della turned one this past year on Elvis's birthday. Mark, Deb, Henry, and Della are important friends in my musical life. The blinders I wore as regards to my lifelong violin relationship kept me from letting many non-violin sides of life into my life. So a look and my musical past life can be a little heady and disconcerting. I tend to like to think of my current fascinations with music and art, so I will do what I can to mix the two in a reasonable way. I had quit playing at age 20. I had left my musical studies at Indiana University in the midst of depression. I got the violin out again 6 months later when I was asked to be in an orchestra for a memorial concert for peace for Leonard Bernstein. I had been a student at Tanglewood in 1988 and had played under the baton of Lenny. At that time also, I began to go to Charlie's Jam, a weekly Sunday afternoon folk and blues jam led by Charlie Alexander. I have yet to find much like it. It is still a very enjoyable part of my life. Here in Kansas, I enjoy the Ashland Jam here in Manhattan, Roll Grit in the Kansas City, and the Americana Jams, Americana Music Academy Jams in Lawrence. In Dallas, I enjoyed Michael Pilecki's Jazz Jam at the Black Dog Tavern. They all involve people and music and memories of great nature. Something else I found through Charlie's Jam was the Sunday night open mic at Club Dada in Dallas. From 1991 until 2005, I played classical pieces on its stage in between rock bands. There I met Haunchy, William Kelly, Kendall and Fiona, Daniel Katsuk and AAA, and Thin Lizard Dawn, while I performed Bach, Kreisler, and Bloch. Tom Prejean was the very funny and witty MC and originator of the experience. In 2005, I played at a musicians panel discussion at the Hockaday School, my school, and I performed the preludio from the E major partita by Bach. It went very well, and I think I've never been so thankful that something went well. This was a piece I played regularly at both Prejean's open mic and Charlie's jam. I told Tom that I was thankful to have played that piece for so many years on the club stage that it prepared me for my moment at Hockaday. He replied jokingly that he was glad that we had finally found what that had been good for. It was October when I started lessons, about a month before my fourth birthday. I started Suzuki violin, a method that utilizes the natural learning aptitude that every child has at that young age, barring disability. I don't even remember my first lesson, and I'm thankful that I started at an age where new things seemed as easy as brushing the teeth. Practicing was a daily fight, and when I threatened to quit around the beginning of my full day at school years, I was told that I could quit, but then we would move out to the country. I tried to practice my violin one day next to the combines and tractors and things, but these wasps kept flying by and tarantulas kept moving across our yard, and those men kept sopping up the sweat off their foreheads and big dirty trucks kept pulling up in the yard with big men with big problems kept getting out. Big sweaty men with big loud trucks driving over big tarantulas, shooing away big red wasps to talk to my little parent, and I just couldn't practice. I remember many things from those years. Sometimes I feel that those years are as close up in my face now as what I experience now. The day before birthday was the mass murder-suicide of the Jones congregation. The bodies I saw on TV looked like so many rag dolls, my favorite one tucked under my arm while viewing the strange and horrifying news. A gas station down the street from me exploded along with the culprit tank. We heard it from our home on a state lane. The library hill down the street was perfect for winter sledding. A recent visit showed me a parking lot in most of that hill's place. At least the library is still there. Numerous between-house football games went on. Once again, my last visit to Dallas showed me tall fences on the same ground. My parents put me in violin lessons due to my shyness. I used to think of my previous shyness as a positive trait. I know now through many years of help that shyness is an acquired habit, and one due to happenings that generally are not good. But my voice was my violin. Things I was not allowed to say and things I was not allowed to be came out on stage. A place I loved more than any place. It was my briar patch. And people enjoyed watching me there, and I enjoyed them watching me. I think this one would be a good one to watch the tree during, if you like. My song to music. We pull one note from this string, it lifts hastily and rests before us. Take the note and slice it with your bow. The note has its own rings, one ring for every year. The more practice hours, the more intricate the lines. Tears shed give a blue aura, Some notes crackle dry, born of hatred. Rings that are moist and rotting should be tended with a little sun so the music doesn't lay heavy in our head, pushing our feet down into the mud. Appreciation of life glows inside the note and carries it across the ocean. Once all the rings are tallied and pondered, take your instrument and sit beneath the tree from which it came, if you can find it. When birds landing on branches cause the dew to splash down, do not move. Take the water and the dripping sap in the face, a morning bath from an old friend. To avoid summers in the country, I went to Metamount, an exclusive practice and performance camp, an eight-week residential facility in the Adirondacks. Then and now, I think of my four summers there in the mid-80s as my lifelong saving grace. My learning there, I believe, is the reason I still play today. The camaraderie of all string players and all practicing at least the same 5 hours every day at the same time was necessary to my musical and social development. I look at the current shortened summer length, and I'm thankful I was a student when 8 weeks was available. The violin for me became as a mission of light from a very young age, one that was quite religious in intent. Although I feel my performances did bring love and music to many in my audiences, I know that the level of my mission put my young life that was already off balance even more off balance. Over time, I grew to appreciate and really use pre-concert nervousness to my onstage benefit. When I was preteen, however, I worried in my nervousness. Perhaps I appealed to my mother, or maybe she offered unsolicited advice. Anyway, she told me once that Jesus would be in the front row, and for me that was kind of what I already believed in my own way still do. I did keep a sort of counsel with my perception of God and Jesus in those years. I saw myself as a sort of mall Santa Claus for them with my violin. I had a child's image of them. In my summer East Texas Sunday school classroom, there were two prints of Jesus paintings. One had the stereotypical long hair, and the other was bedecked with a Prince Valiant look. I always thought that the one with the long hair was Jesus and the one with the short hair was God. How do I explain how my violin was my ticket to all I have experienced, good and bad, in my life? If I went to see a movie, I thought I should be home practicing. If I was home not practicing, I thought, why am I not at a movie? I played many different things after I was not on the soloist path anymore. As I have mentioned, I would play for fun, folk and blues, some jazz, and my favorite was tango. I was lucky to get to perform some tango with the Arts District Chorale in Dallas and also particularly Tango Lorca in Kansas City. I would also have my violin with me all the time. I had a convertible for a few years, and I imagine I had the top down maybe 20 times because the violin was always in the car. My violin life took me to Switzerland, D.C., New York City, and Paris. I got to be in Paris the week of their bicentennial, all due to the violin. If you seek me out as a violin teacher, I will be an excellent coach. I will teach you how to play in tune if you do not already know. I will show you how to practice scales, how to practice your orchestra music, how to practice your pieces and studies. In a similar vein, I can help a kid learn to study their schoolwork, reading, and math using similar practice techniques. But after at least 1,000 lessons, numerous second prizes at competitions, and other experiences I considered unfortunate at the time, there are many sides of teaching the violin for which I don't have much patience. I'm not going to ever be an ace at helping a student complete a series of recitals and competitions. In the 18 years of teaching I've done, I have no interest in forcing a student to learn everything by memory. I believe they should, I just cannot be the one who's going to wholeheartedly get behind the effort. Should I take a quick sip to Lenny? March 20th, 2011. Dear Diary, I played at the conveying of ashes ceremony a few weeks ago. I just played sounds and drones, no particular melody, just pieces of music. Two geese started to sound from far away. I began to play with their sounds to leave holes for their singing. When they came around the bend, I stopped playing and just listened. They were part of it and the most beautiful part of it. Years ago, I played a quintet in a beautiful home, that of Dorothea Kelly's, in Dallas along Turtle Creek. My favorite thing about our fellowship here, as I have mentioned, are the magnificent grand-scale windows looking out on the trees. At this Dallas home, the living room where we played was surrounded by one large window where one could watch the creek. A friend there told me that as I started to play the viola, a duck came around the bend and sat in the creek and listened. I played for the Kansas City Guitar Society with Mark Bentley, classical guitarist. Throughout our hour-long performance in Loose Park, two hawks settled into the trees behind us and listened during our playing. Apparently, the clapping between pieces sent them flying, but when the music restarted, they always came back to hear and to see us. March 22nd, 2011. Just came from the hot tub at the Stagecoach Inn in Salado, Texas. This place feels a little like a Swiss chalet. Visited friends of mine in Austin, particularly Mark Ambrose, who wrote Shadow on the Moon, and his children and wife, Deb. It finally feels like spring break. I called my brother Charles earlier to read me an item from the Lawrence Journal World, My Horoscope by Jacqueline Bigar. The horoscope is a fun piece and sometimes helpful for bringing some new ideas and some balance. But the rest of the paper has changed, as has the Kansas City Star, as well as the Dallas Morning News, as I saw today. In trying to keep readers by changing the style of writing along with the simplified headings, they probably are actively driving away some tried and true readers. In the same way, concerts now, to me, are often unappealing. One reason is that I attended so many in my youth. I now prefer to take in a play when possible. But concerts are now spotted with talk, cluttering the movements and numbers, interrupting the flow of the musical wash. Artists chatting with the audience as if at a cocktail party or after the concert in the lobby, selling wares, signing jackets. Someone please come knock over the post-concert items and let the audience silently make their way to their cars as in a trance. I remember as a child solemnly walking backstage waiting for 5 or 10 minutes while the soloist took a moment to reconnect, a backstage hush lined with sweat. March 27th, 2011. There is nothing in the world like applause and a standing O, a standing ovation. I simply love it more than anything in the world. But music has a place also for not being acknowledged with applause. Instead, that is acknowledgement with healing. Whether as part of a funeral or a wedding service, a Sunday morning service, or in a hospital room, sometimes it is more fulfilling to be acknowledged with silence, indicating absorption. I don't feel bad after a service performance if someone has not clapped for me. Rather, I enjoy most the glow of silence following a contemplative piece, an indication that my music is serious business. When in this service you hear us play, please be free to the feeling that you are obliged to applaud in recognition of our years of training. Rather, on occasion, let us place the music in the air and return to our seats in concentration of what else we may hear within the hour. And in doing so, you allow us to continue to feel what we just placed at your feet. It heats our insides, as hopefully it does yours, makes the days more bearable. March 29th, 2011. It's a real honor to get to speak to you about my violin life. No one has asked me to do such a thing before. They've asked me to play at the blessing of a child. A woman asked me to play for a private dinner for she and her husband at their home. She became very drunk by mid-meal, and I noticed that things were very wrong between them. I was asked to play for 6 years at the Nana Grill. I was asked to play in a symphony, and then I was asked to leave. I was not asked to a prom, nor ever to be married. I was asked to play under the baton of Leonard Bernstein while he was alive, then asked to play with others on his way out, with special attention to his work for disarmament. I was asked when I was 5 to stand with a fellow violin classmate at our school, Lamplighter School. Melanie Sanford and I stood on a table in the music room and plucked Mary Had a Little Lamb for our fellow preschoolers. She came to an elementary school reunion I had in 1996. She is also the first classmate I know of who has died. The violin was there through every time I was in trouble. After I was punished, it was glaring at me to practice it. It was there when there were better feelings, yet it still resounded with much bad. Then I got into middle school, where I was generally very happy with good friends and great mental and physical health. When I was 13, I performed with orchestra the Mozart Concerto No. 3, conducted by Charles something, I can't remember his last name. It was the beginning of my love affair playing as soloist with orchestra. There's absolutely nothing like it, and I got to do it many, many times. Now, such experiences come in my dreams as I stand before an orchestra, realizing I no longer have the Sibelius memorized, and my music is nowhere to be found. My violin came with me through treacherous depression, saw me through 3 tumultuous years of music school. Music school is extremely difficult, by the way. And then it was there when I finally got some excellent help for my mental sadness and anger. Depression is actually real anger turned in on oneself. I still so much enjoy playing. I probably shouldn't speak again about music, perhaps only small doses. Looking back on my life years of violin, joy and sadness was so hard. I have touched my violin, my friend the violin, almost zero since my delving into these words. Now I will not speak of the violin again, only play violin, only make love to the people through the violin. I'd like to list all of my private teachers in order of my study. Dr. Evelyn Herman, Arkady Fomin, Emmanuel Borak, Yuval Yaron, Sally Thomas, Ann Setzer, Nelly Shkolnikova. My favorite coaches have been Lev Aronson, Felix Gallimere, Clarice Candamio, Louis Krasner, Jan Sloman, Julius Levine, Beau Bledsoe. The most moving performances I've experienced were Ted Jostelson, Stephanie Arado, Juan Luca Eisenberg, Nadia Solano-Sonnenberg, Liana Isakadze, Vladimir Horowitz, Britton Smith, Gideon Kremer, and Andrew Bemis. Favorite conductors have been Christopher Larkin, Richard Gengiulio, Kirk Trevor, Misha Sabinitsky, all my Tanglewood conductors, and Miguel Harth Bedoya. My favorite pianists to play with are Noni Dressler in St. Louis, Slavomir Dobrinsky here, Marilyn Caldwell, and Stephen Mall, all here as well. Favorite teachers of other subjects, Carolyn Helfman, Norman Dumain, Barbara Nichols, Pat Mattingly, Alan Hausman, all of my staff from MHTP. And my favorite spots in the world, the Cy Twombly House at the Minow Collection in Houston, Memphis's National Ornamental Metal Museum, and the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. I think what I'd like to leave mainly is the thought of just enjoying live performances. I once saw a little boy with the biggest smile I've ever seen run with a red balloon on a stick right up to his dad, and it was just the greatest moment. And the dad reached over to the side table and clicked a picture of him rather than give him a big hug as he walked up. I think music is similar experience. I wish sometimes when parents go hear the see the performances of their children, they just put the cameras down and experience this as it's happening, because that's then it'll be remembered. Recorded music is never the same as live. I think the production of my CD, in some ways, I think made me a little lazy about continuing to play as much as I had in the past because then it was recorded, but nothing on my CD will ever be experienced the same way as the, you know, people in the audience experience. And in fact, I would say that out of all my lists, the most important, the people I remember are the ones that came to my performances. I will end with one more poem. The Diamond Cutter's Dilemma, Part 1. That thin silvery thread strapped upon with cautious confidence. No, no cautiousness. Go to the A string to practice closer to the netless ground. How come the monkey, while swinging from tree to tree, never misses? When does an actor not worry about missing a line? Why does the diamond cutter, how does the diamond cutter live? The flight of the bumblebee, mistake-ridden. A clean moto perpetuo. How is it done? Why do I worry since age 13 that memory will slip and I won't play clean? Why does the prompter prompt without mistake? They have to. A prompter with slips of the eye, they will lose their job. Is this a question that others don't ask? Why insist upon knowing when you die? Falling once makes it easier the next fall. Why not plant the first fall so the next one doesn't hurt as much? I've answered my question. Thank you so much. we have a closing hymn.
Number 318, Stand As You Are Able. Amen.